Good morning, and welcome to the CSP Radio Show, presented by Crawford Stewardship Project. I am your host and CSP Agriculture Coordinator, Joseph Childs. Today, we are going to explore the topic of monopolies within the food industry and how the growing number of agricultural business monopolies affects all of us, both producers and consumers, and the small towns that we know and love. To help us explore this topic, I've invited Austin Frerich, author of the book Barrens, in which he covers this very topic in great detail and dives headfirst into the issue of concentration in the food supply chain. Austin was a keynote speaker at Wisconsin Farmers Union Convention last month and caught my attention when speaking about just how widespread the effects of monopolies are and the policies that are in place that make it possible for them to exist. Welcome, Austin. So glad that you could join us today. And first things first, I'd just like you to give a little bit of a background on your book, Barrens, and what readers can expect from it.
Yeah, so my book profiles seven different robber barons in the food system. And part of it is I'm using that robber baron as like a narrative device to tell bigger structural stories. So like, you know, I have a grain baron in my book, but that's really the story of the farm bill and changes in the farm bill over the last century. So that's kind of what I'm doing in my book, is telling you these different concepts in the food system and building on them. And at the same time too, I really wanted to use that robber baron framework to show people we've been here before. I think we're living in another gilded age, another laissez-faire moment, and to also show people that we know what to do here. We know how to overcome this concentrations of power that is corrupting the political system. So it's both kind of an entertaining way to tell these stories, but also to kind of, you know, really put this in like a historical context for folks.
It's a very interesting book. I've read about three quarters of the way through it right now, and I've read quite a few other books along those lines. And in fact, did a radio interview here on WDRT about The Meat Racket by Christopher Leonard, and it dives into specifically the chicken and pork industry with Tyson. But you mentioned talking about the farm bill, and you know, we've been here before. So can you tell me what mechanisms have allowed these barons to exist? What is put in place that makes this not only incentivized, but really it's kind of the only way to operate at the moment?
Yeah, well, let me first just start by saying I adore that book, Meat Racket, you mentioned. It's one of my favorite food books. I recommend it to anyone. Also, I should just say that author, Chris Leonard, is one of my favorite writers. To your question about robber barons and how they got here is, I think when I started this book, I had this notion of, oh, these are the, you know, most efficient, the biggest, most technological advance. But then when you start lifting up the hood and investigating each market, you realize, oh, these are just an old classic story of corporate capture. And I guess we shouldn't be shocked. I mean, never forget, let me step back for a second. The goal of any corporate executive is monopoly. That's where profits are. Because, you know, competitive markets are hard. It's ruthless. So you wake up every day, how do I beat my opponent? Your goal is you want to corner a market so then you can kind of, you know, get a little cream off the top. And so, I mean, that's, to me, is like kind of the story of the American economy right now. It's just a lot of markets are concentrated. And I think the food industry in America is the most concentrated space in America. Because, you know, even when we talk about like slaughterhouses or milk, we use national figures, but you're not going to take, you know, Wisconsin milk and sell it in Seattle. You know, milk is local, it's regional. And once you start using regional numbers, these markets are even more concentrated. Like Pete Harding of Oregon, Wisconsin did a paper for me at a conference a few years ago where one company has an 85% market share in fluid milk in New England. And I don't need a PhD in econ to know those people are not paying a fair price for milk. So that's what I kind of do in each chapter, is kind of show which corners were cut in this like bigger race to the bottom. Because here's the thing, like the family farm doing pasture dairy can't compete on price against a dairy baron who's cutting corners and engaging in questionably legal things. And I think for me intellectually, is I wanted to write this book to understand how those corners were cut, because you have to understand how the corners were cut in order to fix them. It's as simple as that.
Now, are these legal corners that are being cut? Are these loopholes that are left open that are being exploited? Or is this something that is illegal that these operations are doing?
I would argue all the above. I mean, I should also say writing this book is every commodity is different. And every production region in America is different. And I got to be very careful with my words here, just because, I mean, even consolidation, the book industry means the liability now is on me. So what kind of shocked a lot of people reading my book is I have nearly 1,000 citations, and that's because, you know, if I'm wrong, the barons can sue me. So I had to cross my T's, dot my I's. So I just want to be very careful with my words here. But it seemed, I would argue that there is some, you know, illegal things going on, but also just old-fashioned buying up politicians and corrupting the political system to reinforce current economic structures that benefit a few.
That's where I seem to think that a lot of this happens is it's shady but completely legal, and it's not like they went out looking for the loophole that already exists. That it seems like they knew what they wanted and they got the right person involved and brought that policy forward themselves to create the loophole for themselves. Now, does that sound kind of how like the process works, or is this just kind of dumb luck, they stumble upon something?
No, I don't ever use the word dumb here. That is, it's a weird thing to say to write a book like this, but there is a level of business brilliance to a lot of these people. You got to respect that. But then there's also a unethicalness to them. Like take Sam Walton. So Sam, my grocery baron, they sell 1 in 3 groceries in America. It is brilliant what the company built. At the same time, too, they really exploited certain legal loopholes. Like one example is a lot of the stores when they started off were their own legal entity, because back then you could essentially you didn't have to pay minimum wage if things were small. So, you know, they were paying wages half the minimum wage. You know, is that, you know, that's a, you know, you're exploiting a loophole in that case. So, you know, you can both admire and also fear some of the power of these people. That said, I kind of view this almost as a toolkit. So sure, there is, you get big, you write regulations to your benefit. The other two things I've noticed is what they tend to do is, you know, maybe you're doing something illegal, but then you use your economic power to corrupt the political system to then make that behavior legal. Or another common thing, and I see this more with my hog baron, is you just basically gut or like defund an agency so no one can kind of keep an eye on what you're doing. So who knows if what's going on there or not. I mean, that is like the big, there's a lot of unknowns here. It's kind of what I realized is just no one's keeping an eye on a lot of these markets. You know, the cops aren't on the beat.
Mm-hmm. So, it might be illegal, but there's no enforcement. So if there's no enforcement, is it really going to deter people? Now you're just relying on people's morals. And as we see time and time again, money creates looser morals with most businesses and entities. And I wanted to talk a little bit more. So we kind of got it narrowed down on what mechanisms are there that allow this to happen. So now that it's happening, who cares, right? Why should the average consumer or the average farmer care? What impact does it have on them? And why should they read your book? And why should they feel a little bit, irritated about this, that it's happening?
So for just like your average, I don't want to use the word consumer, but like your average American out there listening, to me, this impacts you directly two ways. One, it makes for bad tasting food. I think that's the underappreciated thing with the current system is, you know, like especially meat and dairy inputs matter. If you're drinking milk coming from cows on a industrial feedlot in the Mexico desert, that's just not going to make a good product. Whereas like a cow on pasture eating a rich grass diet is going to make such a better product. Even like my berry baron, you know, they became a baron because, you know, they grow berries now on every continent in the world except Antarctica. So some days your berries are coming from Argentina, sometimes it's Morocco. But here's the thing, that berry's not engineered for taste, it's engineered for durability. So that's one thing, is just a kind of collapse in taste, why a lot of food's kind of anymore. And the second thing is what you're paying. I mean, you're being gouged. It's a little aggressive to say, but we're paying more for junk. Dollar for dollar, Americans spend more money on food than people in Germany, Canada, United Kingdom. And we're about dollar for dollar even with Italy. And trust me, anyone that's been to Italy knows what a dollar gets you there is so much better than here.
I just returned from Rome, and I can honestly say every single meal that I had there was like life-changing almost. I had a pepperoni pizza that shifted how I looked at pizza for the rest of my life. And it was just a small restaurant. It wasn't expensive. It was, the food there is a lot cheaper, and it's just, frankly, a lot better.
And that's like what, just on a personal note, so my husband and I actually did our honeymoon in Italy because I wanted to see a food system that worked. And we had the same reaction where, like, you're having an incredible meal that you're spending $30 on, for two people, maybe 40, including wine. And you kind of see what the system could be. And you also just realize, I mean, you realize how far off our system's gotten. And like that, if there's a silver lining I have writing this book is I've gotten a lot of positive press from the business world, like Bloomberg especially, because a lot of upper-class Americans that go abroad, they just see the food's better, cheaper, and healthier for you abroad. Like, our country's just not making good food. And that, to me, is a ray of hope, is everyone's kind of seeing the system not work. And, like, you know, what the system means for farmers is, first of all, most farmers cannot compete on price against these people cutting corners. And so a lot of them are going bankrupt. And at the same time, or the ones left standing, is they're both being squeezed on the input side from consolidation, but also on the output side, because they have less people paying for their product. And so you're, to me, the bigger story here is not just farmers, but it's rural America is producing the most it's ever produced, but none of their wealth is staying there. You know, you're just seeing this being extracted because they don't have the power. And I think the best stat that captures it is USDA has published for nearly a century the stat where for every dollar you spend the store, what does a farmer get? And after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt implemented his farm bill reforms, you had more than 50 cents on the dollar going back to the farmer. But now, you know, after this massive consolidation of power, farmers get the lowest ever recorded in American history. It's like 13 cents. So just imagine for a moment what that would mean for rural America if it was 50 cents to 13 cents of their, you know, what they sold and came back to them, what you buy at the store goes back to them. How much that would just change this country. So like that to me is like, that's just the bigger picture here. It's a system just not working for most people, except for a few that are benefiting at our expense.
So just to kind of to wrap up your summary there, like the average consumer is paying more for less quality food, and the average farmer is going to be seeing less money at the end of the year. And as inputs rise again and again, it seems like there's consolidation in the stuff that you're making and selling as a farmer. There's consolidation, and also the stuff that you're buying that you need to, whether it's seed or chemical or equipment or animals, it seems like there's less and less sellers of those. So you're getting squeezed on both ends, and that is a direct cause of, that is a direct result from this consolidation in the agricultural space.
Oh, exactly. I mean, that is exactly what's going on here.
So this is a question that you often get from those who are either in that agricultural space begrudgingly, or maybe they are actually big fans of growing corn and soy or having large-scale dairy and pig operations, defending the system, saying, you know, we have to have this. There's too many people. We need to feed the world. So is there a system that has large-scale industrial operations but they don't act as barons? Is there a system that is created where that works, or is it just inherently not going to work?
Well, let me start with the premise. I don't trust anyone that says feed the world and likes ethanol in the same. Because you're taking the best farmland in the world and you're wasting it in your car, and you're making prices go higher, and you're causing people to starve. Like, let's just be very clear on that point.
Do you happen to have, I've often wondered, I've heard a lot of different numbers being thrown out, but do you happen to know the percentage of corn that gets grown for ethanol use, for not foodstuffs whatsoever, just goes directly into ethanol production?
Yeah, so USDA actually publishes these figures, and about 2 years ago, for the first time ever, ethanol became the largest use of corn. I don't think it's 50%. I think it dances around 48%. You know, I think low 40s is used for industrial animal feed, and then a small chunk is used for like corn syrup and stuff. But it's around there.
So with those numbers, and you could extrapolate you could extrapolate that 48% of the acreage used for corn is not used for growing food. I mean, that's not a far stretch to assume.
I will say what people will respond, you know, big ag people will respond to that point is, well, you can use some of the grain left over when you process ethanol for like confinement feed, but you're only using a portion of it. And let me reiterate, you're using fossil fuels to grow this feed for corn, which at its best is a wash for the climate, ethanol. At its best. Like, it's not good for the climate. Like, let's just be very frank on that. There's no conversation to be had there. So you can get some of it back, but it still doesn't justify not growing produce. The other thing to your point, though, to your question, is I think what I've really come home back to is I kind of view a lot of this as Goldilocks. Like, you know, there is efficiencies from being bigger, and every market's different. Like, but at some point, too, it does cross a line. Things get too concentrated, and they corrupt the political system. And I think that's just the point where we're at. How do we get back to that sweet spot, that Goldilocks? You know, there's a lot of big meat companies, but a lot of them aren't employing child labor. You know, but there's a certain few that are, and they keep pushing the envelope. And I think the bigger thing of this moment is you're just not seeing the accountability that should happen. People should be punished for breaking laws, and they're not.
That we'll talk a little bit more later about this, but when we talked about JBS, that's the Brazilian meat packer. There's some, you brought up, you know, slaps on the wrist with for those guys when it'd be the equivalent of fining me 10 cents for a parking ticket. I'm going to park in that same spot every day for the rest of my life then, because it doesn't mean anything to me.
I'm glad you said that phrase, Joe, slap on the wrist, because so every chapter is kind of built around an idea. And when I was researching JBS, I view myself as like meat's kind of what I know. It's my forte. And I was even shocked at how often they've engaged in very questionable business practices. I'm going to be very careful with my words here because this one's very litigious. But when I was researching and writing that chapter, I just kept being like, oh, this is like a child that has never been punished by a parent. So they keep pushing the envelope. And like, that's why I kept thinking of slap the wrist. You know what I mean? At some point, like, the kids does something bad and they don't face consequences, they're going to do it worse. And that's what JBS is. And so I kept, if you notice in that chapter, I use that phrase slap the wrist a lot because I wanted that to be the key idea you took away from that chapter is this is what happens when companies do not face consequences, is it gets worse.
So you had talked a little bit earlier about enforcement not being there. And this kind of leads into my next question, because I think there's got to be a two-pronged attack. There's got to be the policy put in place that allows for the enforcement, but we also need to have the enforcement there. So this next question, it will be a little bit of a two-parter. So what specific, and I know policy is very, very long-winded and can be confusing on purpose sometimes, but is there a specific policy where you could go, if we just crossed this one out or changed this a little bit, we could do away with a large majority of how this operation is going so far?
Like how to fix these like markets, or what do you mean
like,
by that?
So I guess is there one certain thing that like policy that was put in that really opened the doors, where like is there one loophole that is used again and again and again by these companies? Or is it really just the enforcement is not there? Like the policies are in place and the enforcement is not there.
Gotcha. So you're asking what's the original sin?
Essentially,
I would
yes.
say the big is the collapse of antitrust enforcement in America in the early 1980s, I think really ushered in this. President Reagan basically stopped enforcing our anti-monopoly laws, which allowed, you know, companies, a lot of these companies, it's not organic growth. Like JBS did not sell an ounce of meat in America, you know, 20 years ago. They entered, I believe, in America in 2005. And it wasn't like they sold a really good product and they got a lot of market share. It's just instead they bribed politicians to get a lot of cheap money to buy a ton of companies. One of my most powerful slides I show people is I show them 8 different slides, and on each slide are about 12 different meat brands a company owns. So you could be buying their meat and just not know. And that would not have been possible if it wasn't for the Reagan administration basically ignoring that framework that really was, to me, the hallmark of America for a century, that really kept markets competitive. And I mean, like my coffee baron, a lot of the barons in my book is just became barons because they were able to buy companies that they could not have bought just a few decades ago.
So essentially these, like the toothless antitrust enforcement was, these people did the thing that the policy says is wrong, and they never had anyone come in and say, you know what, we cannot do that. We're actually going to stop this merger, or we're going to break up this company.
Bingo. And I will say, though, what kind of contradicts this point is my last baron is Walmart. and they're the king of kings. And they didn't really buy a lot of companies. I mean, Sam Walton got his market share 1 in 3 groceries through, you know, just organic growth. But I will say there was a whole other statute of regulations that were ignored under the Reagan called Robertson-Patman Act. They basically put up guardrails between wholesalers and companies like Walmart, and that basically collapsed, so allowed Walmart to get a lot of market power to squeeze suppliers. But Walmart, to its credit, did not become a robber baron or a giant through acquisitions. It did it through organic growth. So every market's unique, and I always want to be careful too of having a silver bullet answer or silver bullet reason. Is it usually just it's a confluence of things working together to reinforce things to either break markets or to make them better.
And I feel that's why it's so hard to do, or maybe we think it's hard to do, because it's not like if I push this domino down, the next one goes. It's like they kind of all the dominoes need to fall at the same time, because one relies on the other. And you can't just say, well, I'm going to go ahead and do this and change this policy or start enforcing this, when you don't have everything lined up. So it's really the lining all that stuff up, getting the right people in place, and getting the right judges on the Supreme Court that will uphold decisions. And so it's really got to be a perfect storm before you can really bring the gavel down and break these sort of things up.
True, but that's life. I mean, these stuff are complicated. I mean, even when we dealt with these meat companies a century ago, it wasn't one thing that, you know, broke up the meat trust. It was truly a combination of things. And it's, but that's also why I want to harken back to that last Gilded Ages. That last Gilded Age produced a reform movement because people were sick of it. They worked locally to then usher in a reform era. And I think we're on the cusp of that, and it won't be easy. I mean, concentrated interests never give you a seat at the table. You have to fight for it. Mm-hmm. But we've been here before. We do.
So I got to take a second here just for some station identification. My name is Joseph Childs. You're listening to the Crawford Stewardship Project radio show on WDRT 91.9 FM. Radio from the Driftless area of Wisconsin. You can also find lots of other awesome episodes of radio shows and podcasts online at wdrt.org. You can look for this one underneath the radio show archives. We're sitting down with Austin Frerich, author of Barons. We're talking about how the food system in the United States is so concentrated and how that affects the average consumer. The average American, because everyone's got to eat, and the average farmer, and if this is a good thing or a bad thing. And so far, we're learning about all the ways that it's happened, what was put in place to allow these barons to exist and thrive, really, and how, if any, there are policies that can break those up. So we talked a little bit about, it's very complicated. If it wasn't complicated, I'm sure we would have done this by now. But is there a way for, I want to go back to the last question, is there a way for these people to exist? There's going to be large and small companies in no matter what industry. There's always going to be that. But is there a way for those companies to exist without it being a monopolistic market?
Yeah, I mean, but here's the thing, you enforce a lot of basic regulations. A lot of these barons their empires are no longer economically viable. Like, I just think of my hog baron in particular. You treat hog manure like human manure, you know what I mean? It's no longer economical to shove a bunch of pigs into a metal shed. There's like a lot of things like that where, you know, but I don't want to think of should they exist or not. That's not the question. To me, the question is, what should these systems look like? What kind of food system do we want to have on our table? And then kind of let the outcomes be what they be.
And I'm glad you brought up food systems as how you worded it. And to me, that is something that is lost upon the rhetoric that is spewed now, is there's one food system. There's a global food system. That's what people refer to. We're a globalized economy. We're a globalized society. But for me, my food system should not include Brazil or Venezuela or Mexico or even California or Texas. My food system should be much more local than that, and there should be just a massive amount of those food systems, not just one system. So I think just changing the expectation of where you get your food from, and maybe you shouldn't be able to get an orange in January in Wisconsin at any time that you want. Maybe, you know, those seasonal foods and eating locally should be something that we do more often.
Then, like, I would add, there's beauty in diversity. And what I mean by that is, like, one of my favorite things about Wisconsin are the supper clubs. I literally just bought this incredible book series on the supper clubs in Wisconsin, and I love that. Anytime I'm in the state, I try a new one that people recommend to me. And what a cool cultural thing that you don't see elsewhere. And at the same time, too, the beauty of America is we have a place like New Orleans. Like, I mean, who doesn't love red beans and rice? New Orleans is a creature of its own. It's its own food system. How do we have those thrive? How do we, you know, because local food is, I mean, that's what makes a place, is they maintain culture, those local restaurants, those local farmers. And I think so much of this moment now is everything just feels the same vanilla blah. You know, that's what a corporate entity wants. They want to serve you the same industrial pork chop in Maine as you get in New Mexico, but neither one has flavor to them. But I want to get back to that system where we help those local systems thrive, because, you know, I mean, even like, you know, the difference between Iowa and Wisconsin is, like, you know, Iowa has a big maize culture. They love their tenderloins. We love our kolaches. There's all these, like, little things, and they make, I don't know, they make life fun. I can't say that enough. It's pride. People feel pride in the work they do when they're maintaining those local food traditions versus, you know, cooking some frozen thing that you got from, you know, wherever.
Yeah, I've always loved growing up around the area and having, like, people, when you say you're from Wisconsin, they're like, oh, cheese curds. I'm like, yep, cheese curds. I love that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and like, when I lived in Madison, people had really strong opinions on who had the best cheese curds.
Oh, that is a statewide thing for sure. And I know where they are too, and I'm not telling anybody. So we got a couple minutes left here. I wanted to not end on a gloomy note, but what are some things that the average person can do, or maybe if you're not such an average person, if you've got a little bit of entrepreneurial spirit or, you know, some gusto that you want to really help move this along, what are some things that people can do to help mitigate these robber barons, like, to fight against this?
Yeah, I mean, let me just start by really emphasizing the point. This always starts local in America. For example, the first anti-monopoly laws in the world came out of Iowa. It was Iowa farmers mad about grain elevators and railroads. They passed the first anti-monopoly laws. A few states did it. Then the federal government did it. And then finally, you know, Teddy Roosevelt came along and did something. But it started locally. It started with farm organizations. And even in Wisconsin, so much of the New Deal came out of Wisconsin. You know, it was unemployment insurance started in Wisconsin. So I say this because, you know, DC is always the last one to know, but you got to start somewhere. And so just from, like, a local level, things people can do is, you know, a lot of farmers will tell you they don't like doing the farmer's market. You get rained out. It's not consistent. But help pair them up with that local school or the local college so they can, you know, every week they know they're serving carrots or some dairy to the local school. You're keeping your money locally, and it's also better, you know, it's better tasting food. Build on that.
I just had a team breakfast this morning, and we probably talked for 15 minutes about how they didn't like the school food. And I was like, I can't wait to talk with Austin about this, because that was one of his things of, you know, if we want to help out the local farmers and improve the local school's food, you know, connecting people that way, and, you know, maybe just going and starting that conversation, even if you're not a farmer, just start talking about this kind of stuff, you know, bring it to the forefront of people's minds. If you hear this on the radio, maybe point someone in our direction and say there's an episode on food. But we've got a lot more to discuss, Austin, and we're going to continue that in the last hour and a half here on the CSP podcast. But for now, I've been Joseph Childs for the Crawford Stewardship Project radio show, and I've sat down here with Austin Furick, the author of Barons, and talked quite at length about our food system and the concentration in it. We've been listening to WDRT 91.9 FM, and you can find this show online at wdrt.org. Thank you. All right, so Austin, we talked a little bit about the policies that put this in place, and we talked a little bit about Farm Bill, and one of the things that I'm really interested in, and I think a lot of people are, is there's subsidies there that are supposed to be for protection against like disastrous years, and really it ends up just being every single year is a disaster year and there's payments put out. So what is the difference between the stuff that we have now, the subsidy and insurance kind of landscape that we operate within now as farmers, compared to the crop subsidy programs that were really functioned on the idea of production control rather than price control?
Well, first of all, I'm really glad you said the phrase every year is a disaster payment, because that's so true and it's by design. Before we dive into that, to back up, I really focus on the New Deal Farm Bill. I focus on that as like a Goldilocks thing, where you get a little subsidy, but there was a lot of carrots and sticks where in order to get the subsidy, you had to engage in conservation practices. And a lot of that involved taking land out of production. And there's also a limit on how much you could get. So I was trying to find that sweet spot of producing enough, but not too much. And I tell that story in my book, how Cargill, my grain baron, did not like it. They thought FDR was Marxist, evil, yada, yada, because they want to move and process as much grain as possible. And a Goldilocks system stops that. You know, it doesn't want overproduction that gluts markets. That's what they want. They want glutted markets. They want the lowest prices for grain possible. But farmers don't want that because, you know, once markets are glutted, everyone has incentive to keep engaging in destructive environmental practices because they're just trying to save their land and make as little, you know, they're just trying to get by. So you have this, you know, Goldilocks framework take hold in America that was really beneficial for rural America and for the land and for farmers. But you see the Cargill family really systematically attack it.
So I want to jump in quick. You're talking about the Goldilocks system. So when you say that, this is how I'm taking it. I want to just clarify. So the Goldilocks, and when you're talking about the Goldilocks system, it's more focused on limiting the production so that the price stays at a level that is beneficial and economically viable to both consumers and farmers. Is that kind of what I'm hearing?
Yeah, but it wasn't fully limiting. It was just figuring out, to keep in mind, a lot of it was rooted in what came before the Farm Bill, where markets, like everyone thinks in 1920s America is like the flapper, you know, Great Gatsby. But rural America was in the Depression already. I mean, these markets were glutted. Farmers, the government asked them to increase production during World War I because so much farmland was taken out of production in Europe. So farmers stepped in and filled the void. The problem was after the war, there's too much being produced and markets were glutted. So then farmers, because you're making so little, you're incentivized to start pushing your land too much. So then you get the Dust Bowl. You get all these like ecological disasters because of these destructive practices. So a lot of the New Deal came in response to that, where it's like, how do we want farmers to make a good living. We don't want to like straight up saying, you know, you don't want to be like Soviet Union saying we only want this many bushels produced, but you want to understand that there's an incentive to always push the land. So how do you can get some subsidy, but you have to take 10% of your crops out of production or like put your land into rotation. So it's understanding that there's an ecological balance here, that if you don't have these incentives at play, what happens is you just have a race to the bottom.
So you brought up the phrase carrot versus stick earlier, and that was one of the first questions that I actually, the very first question here after those four pillar questions that I wanted to ask you. Is a policy of incentivizing conservation practices enough to move the agricultural industry towards a more sustainable future, or is it requiring that for subsidy payments going to be? So essentially, the carrot is, hey, we'll give you some kickback, or we'll pay you this much per acre if you do cover crops, but you don't have to in order to receive subsidy payments or crop insurance payments. Is that enough, or is the stick arrangement where you do not get the payment unless you do these practices? I have my own opinion, but I'd love to hear what you'd say.
I think it's reasonable to ask certain requirements be met in order to get money from the government. And I think the bigger thing here to keep in mind, too, is the massive growth in absentee land ownership in the agricultural space. What shocks most people is most farmland in Iowa is now owned by non-Iowans. Grandma, grandpa die, kid moved to LA, they put it into a trust, they rent it out. And you can always tell rented land when you drive, because if you're renting land, you know, you're not, you don't.
You use it like a rented car.
Exactly.
You don't care if you hit a deer or a pothole because it's not your car.
Exactly. Or even just like a big thing right now on a lot of urban America is rented homes. I mean, you're going to treat a home you own differently than a home you rent. And it's playing out ecologically across our, you know, in rural America. I mean, it's, and I think because of that, I mean, that's partly why I want these sticks here is just so you have, we know that if you're going to get this money from the government, you have to do basic good conservation practices. Because right now, I should also say though, the system right now is pushing people to engage in these models. To your point earlier about these disaster payments, if you don't push your land, you will not be a farmer. The system pushes you to do corn and soy. If you don't do corn or soy, you're going to go broke because that's by design. So every year is a record corn crop. So that's why you need dumb new artificial uses to soak up the surplus like ethanol. Where logically in a free market, you'd be like, oh, these markets are glutted. How about I grow something else? Let me grow rye. Let me put animals on pasture. But that's not what the system is designed to do. And here's the thing. The system is not designed for the farmer. It's what I realize. It's designed for Wall Street and no one else. It's designed to make corn and soybeans as cheap as possible so we can make chips and pop as cheap as possible. That's it. It doesn't care about eaters, farmers, or the environment these systems operate in.
So I spoke on this a little bit with Philothea Beeson on another radio show on Digging Deep here on WDRT. And I don't think it takes an economist or really a genius to figure out that if you are a company that uses corn and soy as an input, whether it be ethanol or any of the many products that are made with it, that you want those inputs to be as cheap as possible. And right now the subsidy programs in the government are just produce as much as you humanly can, and we will set a price floor so that when the price inevitably goes down below that floor, we will pay you. And I don't think it's a coincidence that we are trying really hard to find different ways to use ethanol and to use corn to make plastics and to have different feedstuffs. And it literally could have been anything else too. It could have been pumpkins. If we would have done that with 60 years ago with pumpkins, we would be producing, we'd be the world's largest pumpkin producer. It's all about what you incentivize is what people are going to do because they're trying to make a living. And that brings up a point of like not blaming these farmers. And I feel that farmers, even though they are the ones practicing doing the thing, you know, they're the ones driving the tractor and spraying the fields and planting the corn and soy. They are simply trying to eke out a living in a system that was designed for them to barely make enough money so that they can continue to provide cheap foodstuffs and inputs for large industries.
Exactly. I mean, that is, it's a classic robber baron trick is to divide people. You realize, no, this is, they're responding to the structure we have at hand, but especially in more grain production places like Iowa, the future is there is no farmer. I mean, most of this grain production will be robotic. And that's like something they won't say. And we got to start thinking about where the system's going and what we want it to look like. Because if we don't, trust me, they have a plan in mind that they're trying to execute.
So what do you see? We've already seen our communities losing farmer after farmer after farmer. I mean, and that's like, we're in rural Wisconsin where it is all farms. And you see a lot of barns sitting empty or farms that got snapped up by the neighboring farm that started to expand. If we don't have something put in place where we start to protect those small farmers and incentivize people that are doing good conservation practices, what would a future look like where these monopolies just continue to exist for the next 50 years and all of a sudden, it's literally just, you can buy pork from Smithfield, you buy chicken from Tyson, you buy beef from JBS, and that is it. What does that look like for rural America?
Well, let me start. I mean, I want to avoid the phrase small, because that it makes it seem precious, like a hobby farm. The bigger thing we've seen in the last few decades is the collapse of the middle-class family farm. And an undercurrent in my book, too, is what is a farmer? And I think the Wisconsin Farmers Union has the best definition of a family farm, where more than half the labor comes from the immediate family. And by that definition, none of the barons in my book are farmers, but they cosplay as farmers. Like my dairy baron, Mike Mikulski, he's been on dirty jobs. He pretends to be a farmer. But are you a farmer if you claim residency at the Ritz-Carlton in Puerto Rico? I would argue no. I would argue that the hundreds of undocumented men that you employ are the actual farmers here. And that to me is the bigger thing here is even like those confinement and more industrial farmers are being squeezed out right now. I mean, there are two types of people that reach out to me since this book's been published that's kind of shocked me. And one is a lot of people who have one or two confinements are being squeezed right now because, I mean, it's a classic thing when a new market or like a shift in the market happens. Like take Uber. When Uber first came to America, they were really cheap. Their predatory pricing is what they call in economics, where you offer below cost, essentially drive out the other person into bankruptcy, like cabs. And then once you kill the other industry, you can essentially jack up prices and recoup your losses. And you saw that with confinements. Is these confinements, these companies offered really good terms to people where people are like, well, I want to do hogs and I can't, the other one's no longer economically viable. So I got it. Well, if I want to keep doing hogs, I got to do it this way. So you sign those things, they lock you in, they kill the other model, the traditional family farm of hog raising. And then what's happening now is they're twisting the screws. Like those terms are no longer as juicy as they once were. And now they're being pushed into bankruptcy or they're being pushed to sell out. And you're seeing the same thing play out now in dairy. You're seeing this play out across the economy where my big concern here is most of these things, you know, what is a farmer will just be, you know, the farmer will be really just a low wage worker for an absentee corporate owner in a faraway city. I mean, yeah. The largest owner of hogs in America is a Chinese multinational corporation. I mean, is that what we want? Or do we want a local entity that lives on their land, pays local taxes, and their local kids to school? Or do we want, you know, people earning $10 an hour working for a foreign multinational?
So I'm glad you brought up the ownership of hogs. And that's one of the things that you had on your kind of prescribed, here's what to do moving forward as a society. And that's banning the ownership of processors from owning their cattle or owning their pigs, owning the chickens. And speaking with people in the past about this sort of thing, believe it or not, I like to talk about this and people just their eyes kind of glaze over. But that's how they get you, is you get to, they kind of sell it as like, oh, we will, you don't have to own the chickens, you don't have to own the feed, we take care of all that, you don't have to worry about it. When in reality, if I'm a farmer that I own the building, I own the land, I own the equipment, I own all the stuff that depreciates and is a taxable asset. So I own all the stuff that a company doesn't want to own, and they own all the stuff that's worth money that is produced. They own the product. So I don't own anything that I can sell to make money unless I sell out and get out of the business. And, you know, Tyson or Smithfield sits there and is like, yeah, you get to pay the taxes on that new barn that we made you put up, or you get to pay the taxes on the 100 acres of land that you own every year, and we get to benefit from the production capacity of that equipment and that land.
Yeah, I mean, that's the classic thing. If they're shifting the responsibility onto you and capturing all the profits, and just to add on to that is just so your listeners know, I mean, that comes from sharecropping. That comes from the exploitative production model in the South after slavery, where white landowners, you know, basically maintained a form of slavery using a sharecropping production model. And all chicken did was basically take that model and apply it to chicken production, because a century ago when we wrote the meat regulations in response to the Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle, we didn't write chicken to the regulations. And that's because there weren't chicken slaughterhouses at the time. People literally just had chicken in their backyard. You brought it in and you butchered it. So chicken was essentially able to exploit the loophole and to take that exploit a model from sharecropping, from black farmers, and apply it to chicken production. And, you know, when you cut all those corners, you shift all the responsibility. It turns out it's really profitable for the corporation. Chicken got started gaining a lot of market share. And, you know, a theme I saw throughout my book was USDA could have stepped in and stopped this race to the bottom, but it didn't. It could have made chicken behave like the other meats. And instead, as you see, a lot of the meat industry has been chickenized, wherever, you know, hogs first chickenized, dairy's chickenizing, where it engages in this really exploitive production model that puts all the costs and responsibilities on farmers and takes away all the money. And we got to move away from that, or else we're just going to have, or else you're just going to keep seeing that system, you know, replicate itself, because it's really profitable for a few people that control it.
What has stopped beef from going the way of the chicken and the hog and dairy, or is it just the last domino to fall?
I think the life cycle of beef is harder. It's much longer than the other ones. It's harder, but you're seeing it. They're actually trying to do it right now. I mean, that is why the beef farmers know the second they lose their spot market, it's over. And what I mean by spot market is, for your listeners, think of it like eBay. You know, companies don't want an eBay system where, you know, everyone can see the bids and people are just bidding against each other for the highest price. Farmers love it because you're getting true what they call price discovery. Like, what is the true price? Because people are bidding in real time. Companies want to move you to what they call production contracts, where you don't know anyone else is being paid. They sign you in a thing. You basically have to take it as is. Companies also want that because, A, it's cheaper on their end because you're not having a bidding system, but also it stabilizes their supply. And beef farmers know that if they lose control of their spot market and they move to production contracts, they're just going to get squeezed and really kill that. And I should also say, you're seeing these now in the Midwest. You're starting to see a lot of industrial beef confinements go up. Because here's the thing too, with this, going back to the farm bill, it pushes farmers to do corn and soy at the expense of pasture, at the expense of, you know, pasture dairy, pasture beef. Because how can you rent, you know, rented land for corn can give you so much more money than land for beef cattle. And so you're seeing a lot of marginal land that used to be in beef production now put into more corn and soy.
So I'm glad you brought up the beef industry, that, you know, confined beef industry is really going to be at the expense of pasture, and not because they're having more and more animals or more and more land taken up by the barns and stuff. It's more that in order to feed a confined beef animal, you need lots and lots of corn, and that is what's taking up the pasture land. And, you know, here in the Driftless area, we obviously are more conducive to pasture because we have steep hills and an abundance of water, so it naturally you lean more towards pasture because you just cannot drive the tractor on some of the land. But I wanted you to, why don't you talk a little bit more about that, like the confined beef, and then how corn and soy is affecting how we raise our animals, really.
Yeah, well, just going back to the Driftless for a second, I mean, it makes logical sense that dairy comes out of it for the reasons you said, the landscape, the rain and all that. So much of the modern American food system is just dumb. It's so dumb that California is number one in dairy. If you've ever been to Bakersfield, you're like, you literally have industrial dairy feedlots next to oil rigs. And you're like, this doesn't make sense from a water standpoint, from a feed standpoint. But it's all short-termism. It's not, and also keep in mind, it's not good for the cows. It's not making a good product. And so that is like the bigger picture of the American food system right now, is just how much of it doesn't make sense. And there's a reason why dairy comes out of Wisconsin, because it made sense back in the day. To the point about corn and soy, and I realized this maybe about a year ago talking to someone in Western Iowa. I just asked this, she's a banker. She does a lot of ag lending. I was asking Liz, why don't I even see silos anymore? And if I see silos in Iowa, they're usually abandoned. And she was explaining to me, so much of this goes back to the farm bill and corn and soy. Farmers used to grow their own grains for their own animals. And now that system's basically been separated. Either you kind of do confinement or industrial animals, or you do corn and soy. And what I realized in that kind of point is, first of all, this makes farmers really, really fragile. Because think of like, rewind the clock, a family farm 30, 40 years ago, when you had 4, 5, 6 different crops going. To me, that's like a diversified retirement portfolio, like they tell you to do, because, you know, in case one crop craters, you have the other ones. And you're also more self-sufficient, I should say. But when you start doing only one or two things and the market craters, you put yourself at a much higher risk of bankruptcy. And I think that's underappreciated. And it makes you dependent on these entities. Because, like, you know, here's the thing. Cargo wants you to grow grain to sell the cargo so it can make animal feed and then sell to a different farmer who needs industrial animal feed.
Yeah. And I got a little bit of a story to chip in there that I think will drive home the fact, because I lived that story. We had a 40 to... right around 40. So I think we peaked at 60 cows when I was younger, up until like fifth grade. I lived right on the farm over by Ferryville, off of Severson Road. And there was a creek running through it. It was a dairy farm. The only thing that we sold off of that farm most years was liquid milk. But the only thing that we ever really brought into that farm was soybean meal for some protein once in a while. Otherwise, we would have, when we did grow soybeans, we would have that processed and we would use our own. But we grew the corn for the silage. We grew the corn that we ground into grain for the cattle. We grew everything that the cows, the hay, like everything we needed to feed those cows to produce that milk, we grew on that farm. And so in years where maybe corn skyrocketed in price and or soybean meal skyrocketed in price, whatever it was, if we had excess, we were able to cash in on that because we would change the way that we fed the cows so that we would have a little bit of excess corn or soybean or whatever it was, maybe hay, that we could sell on the open market because we had multiple different crops. And if milk prices were down and corn was up, then we could capitalize on, you know, feeding less corn because the milk's not worth as much and then selling some corn. So you don't get that now. Right now, for most, especially dairy, it is you buy everything, and then you just produce enough milk that you can function at economies of scale. You generally don't have enough land for you, yourself, or time in the day to feed 10,000 cows.
And just to add on to that, two things that come to my mind is, one, first of all, that's just a more enjoyable way to farm. You know what I mean?
100%.
You're managing these different markets. You're using your, like, you have to think a lot. Like, you have to study the markets.
And there's 60, not thousands. Like,
yes.
You know every single cow, every single calf. I mean, I still remember all of the calves that I raised growing up. Like, I knew most of their names for their whole life. And, like, that's not what it is now. And we would have a cow for 12 years. And if she was kept producing, then we kept her for 12 years. And now these large farms they're getting maybe one or two lactations, and then they're shipping that cow off because they're just so overworked and just, I mean, basically strung out.
So think about that. I mean, not even from an animal perspective, but just from the farmer perspective. I realized that visiting dairies, I was very fortunate that the Wisconsin Farmers Union let me be a writer in residency up 2 years ago for the month of November in Eau Claire. And so I did a lot of site visits talking to people. And you just realize with dairy, they just have such a more intimate relationship with the animal than like hogs, because you're milking that animal twice a day. And like you said, each cow is basically a dog for them. And you can just see the pride they had in them when they talked to you about them. But then now, you know, you're just a low-wage worker for a foreign entity, and your job in a lot of these confinements is you're handling the animals that are really unhappy and really mad. And you can just see the trauma the workers feel, and then what it means for these communities where people don't take pride in their jobs anymore, what it does. And the other thing to your point about your family farm and these different, how you would have your different inputs for the feed, is also just how much better for the climate that is. Instead of having your corn come from 100 miles away, you know, it literally is from, you know, a field over. That is just so much better from a pure climate perspective, but also just it's a fresher product. I mean, there's just so much of, just to go back to my point earlier, so much of this stuff is just illogical. It's just dumb. That is like the story of this era, is just so much of this doesn't make sense. It's so twisted that you're like, let's just go, like, never forget the system we have now is radical. So much of what we're talking about is just returning to a traditional logical model of production.
Yeah, it's, if we were to wipe the slate clean, I don't think we would come up with the same system by any stretch of the imagination. I think there were incremental moves in the wrong direction, and then we just kept going in that direction. And at this point, some of us, not me, but some people are like, well, we're already here. Like, what are we going to do? Go in the complete opposite direction? And myself, I'm like, yeah, that's kind of what we have to do. And if we want to keep going down the wrong road, at some point you got to stop the car and turn around. And I think it's not easy by any stretch of the imagination, but I think there is definitely room for people to stop the car and turn around. So speaking of, you know, turning the car around and making measurable change, what is the reasoning for these policies continuing to exist? Like, what is told to the average voter that when they ask their lawmakers or they ask their representatives, hey, why aren't you going forward with this instead of the old, you know, the stuff that isn't working? Why aren't we introducing something different? What is told to the average person of like, no, that won't work because of X, Y, and Z, and we have to continue with these really kind of screwed up policies in general?
I mean, I think we got to this moment because it was decades of politicians thinking that the passions of a few donors mattered more than the apathy of the masses. But it, you know, it's a classic story of greed went too far. They pushed the envelope too far. And I think everyone's just seeing it not work. It's because I'm just really convinced at my core that there's going to be a moment of reckoning here. They've just gone too far. I mean, you're being gouged at the store from a low quality product and they're seeing children work in slaughterhouses. People are just wrong. It's just morally wrong and angry and bank. And the moment demands another Teddy Roosevelt. And at some point, some wannabe president's going to connect the dots and going to seize the opportunity. Because this isn't like AI. We're not talking AI. We're talking hogs. You know, this isn't rocket science. It's really just a question of political courage.
It's animal science. What I think a lot of farmers are getting to the point of, like, I don't care where you really stand on other stuff. I just want to be able to farm in a way that is enjoyable for myself and my family and also profitable to the point where I can raise a family on it. I believe that the food system, the food policy is an important enough thing to be a single issue voter about because it affects literally everybody in the entire world and not just the U.S. Our food policy makes waves around the entire world.
Yeah, I mean, I would add, you already seen this playing out in two different ways, to your point. One, I really do think this kind of happened this last election cycle. I think the presidential race came down to a few voters in a few states over grocery prices, and let's be very frank. Secretary Vilsack undermined the vice president's campaign by doing absolutely nothing about grocery store prices. In fact, the industry got more consolidated under his watch. That man, at the end of the day, is an industrial dairy lobbyist, and he behaved like someone who wanted to be a lobbyist again. So he put his own personal interests ahead of the vice president's campaign, and I think we saw the results of that. People were mad about grocery prices, especially older Americans. People are very salient to the meat and dairy cases, and people have no, I mean, they're right to feel like they're being gouged because they are at the store. I mean, to me, the best example of it is McDonald's. It's the world's largest buyer of beef, and McDonald's just filed a lawsuit against the beef packers for price gouging. And you would think you would treat your best customer the best way possible, but the fact that McDonald's is doing something tells you where we are. But on the other point to the political hope is, I think one of the most popular and most, honestly, I would say best political appointments of President Biden was a young woman named Lina Khan to chair the Federal Trade Commission.
Lina Khan.
Everyone, I mean, here's the thing. Regardless of your political party, I mean, she crosses political aisles. I mean, you had Matt Gaetz praising her in the Wall Street Journal for being really good at going after big tech. I mean, her victory against Google for being a monopolist is a really, really big deal. And I mean, there's a chance that we're on the cusp of Google being broken up into companies for being a monopolist. But I should also say, all the young kids want to be here. She walks into any law school in America, she packs a room, because she's like the embodiment of that statue of that little girl taking on the Wall Street Bull. People want to see a public servant do something and put points on the board, and that's what she's doing. And that is, I think you're going to see a lot of people realize the success she's had, and they're going to try to copy it, and that's the hope here.
Can you explain just a little bit more background on Lina Khan, like what the position she holds and what the power of that position and what that person is supposed to do and what she's doing that hasn't been done?
Oh, yeah. I mean, she's a living historical figure, and that, I mean, it all started because something she wrote. I mean, that's the most incredible thing about it all. She wrote an article in law school saying, you know, Amazon's a monopolist, and we should go back to our old-fashioned antitrust enforcement and break them up, and how this current, you know, this Reagan-era framework is just breaking everything. You know, it's just illogical. And that article went viral. And then President Biden appointed her to the Federal Trade Commission, which is basically the cop on the beat here. the company that oversees and polices American markets, and she filed anti-monopoly law cases against all the big tech companies. And here's the thing, though. She has antitrust authority over every market in America except meatpacking. That's under USDA. So that's why the ball's been dropped there, is Vilsack chose not to do something to reform these markets, and Lena can't do anything about it. And then just on a personal note, I mean, honestly, that's what got me into this whole space, is I met Lena back in 2016, and I was at Treasury in a different life. I was a tax economist, and I wrote about paper, the growth of monopolies and the tax code. And I was like, oh, what's going on here? And I Googled around, and I found something where before she was a law student, she was an academic, she was a journalist, and she wrote about chicken monopolies. So I read her article, we got coffee, and she told me about this whole antitrust stuff. And I was like, oh, that really explains what happened to Iowa in my lifetime. You know, Iowa used to see animals when you drive, and now you don't. You smell them, but you don't see them. And you just see the anger fill that void, you know, the collapse of the middle in Iowa. Like, to me, Iowa really is canary in the coal mine here, where Iowa should be the Tuscany of North America, has some of the best soil, yet has second highest cancer rate in America, has an obesity crisis and a water crisis. You know, it's just, this is what this model produces. And Lena is helping usher in this like reform era. She's like the bottomy of that. And so I think that's why she's an incredible figure. And she's also young. I mean, she is 34 years old. She's a young mom. Like, it's just, she's one of those things in American history you see, and you're like, it gives you hope for this democracy of like, people like that are what save and make the system better.
That's an excellent description of Lena. I've seen her speak a few times in DC, and she's always been extremely inspirational, and like, I would say like on the verge of like bringing people to tears, because these farmers that have spent their entire lives, their entire livelihood, being price takers on both ends. You don't get to say what you're going to pay for your inputs, and you don't get to say what you're going to get paid for when you go to sell. And so these people, especially in the last, I'd say, 40 years, have really been driven out of the industry or driven to the edge of the industry and not seen a lot of hope. And even if they are still practicing farming, they're likely not doing it in a way that brings them joy on a day-to-day basis. And we've talked about this on this show before, about the mental health of a farmer in America and the fact that you're multiple times more likely to commit suicide as a farmer in America than any other occupation. And she has brought some hope to people of like, oh, there is somebody that is not just my neighbor complaining. This is somebody that is in the power, in the seat, that can break these things up and help people. And they're actually doing it. So unfortunately, that's rare, is like, oh, you're the person that's in charge of this and you're actually taking your job seriously and doing what you're supposed to be doing. I know that's it. It was very touching to hear her speak multiple times. And I think a lot of people have put their eggs in her basket, so to say.
That, but let me just add on like to that is the notion of like, no one's going to give you a seat at the table. You have to fight for it. And like, you know, President Biden just didn't appoint Lena out of the goodness of his heart. Is a lot of people around her in that big tech antitrust reform movement worked really hard, not only to elevate her so people knew who she was, but also like really push him to nominate her. You know, it's a lot. You can actually get things done if it's, you know, someone with a reform mind in the seat of power versus just another hack for industry. And never forget, when you elect a president, you're electing thousands of political appointees. And the question is, who do you want to have? Who's going to be in these positions of power? I mean, we were doomed the second President Biden announced Vilsack as Secretary of Agriculture, because it's just, oh, here's an industrial dairy lobbyist taking over. And to me, the really scary thing with Vilsack is not even just the meat stuff, is he's really bungling the bird food crisis, where, I mean, you had Vanity Fair reported earlier this month, he undermined the White House efforts. The White House came in really hard early on against the bird flu, because first of all, these are people that cut their teeth with COVID, and they were so afraid of this getting out of hand. But they also understood the long-term implications of, if this is not handled well, people could really just drop their dairy consumption overnight. And Vilsack, being the industrial dairy lobbyist he is, overruled the White House and undermined them and really did a lackadaisical approach to getting this thing in control. And he failed to do it. And now this thing is starting to get out of control. I mean, it is, these next few months will really determine the trajectory of it. But this is what happens when you get a lobbyist. He only cares about himself. There's no long-term thinking. And people like Lena is, that's why I tell every group I speak to, is you should be going to every governor and every president being like, these are who we want positions of power, you know? Because, you know, that's what really matters in the day is you can write a good report, but that doesn't change things. You got to get people at the table. You got to change who's at the table to change things.
So I wanted to dive in a little bit more on what you said earlier about Lena, like, she is in charge of every single market except meatpacking. So it's in charge of antitrust for those markets. So when was that power given to the USDA? Is it something that they've always had? Or, like, why is that in the USDA's hand? They are an agricultural... I get that they're an agricultural agency, but they're not an antitrust agency. So the antitrust is, I feel, the more important part about that, not what the market is in. The same reason we don't leave, you know, a tech agency in charge of antitrust for the tech space is because it's more about the antitrust than what the market is.
I would say, I mean, I guess I kind of come from the notion of so much of this stuff is we're trying to make things that are century old work and today, and like, why not just pass new legislation? Like, the reason for that USDA CARVA, that goes back a century, but it's 2024. Let's stop trying to make a law from the 1930s work. Let's just pass new legislation. And I mean, Congress doesn't work anymore. It's a do-nothing Congress. I mean, even the one that bothers me the most, I think is the most comical, is the federal milk order. That whole dairy is one of the most complex farm programs out there, and it's all based on a system. Like, when the legislation was written, was before we had refrigeration. So the whole dairy system in America is based on a pre-refrigeration era where, you know, milk really did have a short shelf life. And that's just, we just live in a different era. Yet we cannot pass new legislation to address refrigeration. Like, give me a goddamn break. Congress doesn't want to do its job. And I mean, why not? It could pass legislation tomorrow. 2 pages basically taking that antitrust authority from USDA and giving it to the Federal Trade Commission. But it doesn't. I mean, that's like the thing to keep in mind is this stuff isn't complicated. It's just politicians like Congress not wanting to do its job.
I feel there's probably quite a few things that could trace back to that reasoning outside of the scope of agriculture.
I'm just sick of trying to make antiquated laws make sense in the modern era. Like, every market's different. Things evolve. You got to evolve with them. You know what I mean? Like, you wouldn't use a horse-drawn combine. Like, you're not going to take a horse and buggy out to do your land. You know what I mean? Like, let's be really frank. The future of a lot of grain production is going to be robotics. What does that mean? Let's start thinking that way instead of thinking the 1930s mindset.
So if you were able to snap your fingers and make the changes and have an agricultural, you know, an agricultural space that you'd be proud to say, like, this is the way it should be functioning. Like, what is the priorities that you see for changing the agricultural system? And then obviously there's a balance between industry and conservation. So, like, what is the space that you see? Is it small farms making a comeback where it's 40 cow dairies? Is it, you tell me what would your perfect agricultural space be?
My two things are, I'd rather think from a guardrails perspective, like, what should the protections be and then let the systems play out. And like, my two big things from like a very top level is, one, I think the farm bill should subsidize farm practices, not certain crops. Because right now the farm bill picks favorites. It picks corn, not carrots. I don't like picking favorites. I think we should just take those crop insurance, commodities, and conservation, put in all the one big pot of stewardship payments, and just sit there and say, if you do prairie strips, you get this amount of money. You do cover crops, you get this. A different toolkit. So, because every farm's different. let the farmer decide what's best for their land, but we should stop the picking of the favorites. The second thing is put animals back in the land. I mean, this is one of my favorite things to say, and it's probably it's my most popular thing. I've said that phrase before, people stand up and clap because it's so simple. But it's just because people also see how broken this industrial system is. I mean, it's just morally wrong that, you know, a dairy cow can be in a metal shed all day and never see a blade of grass her whole life. And so how do we get back to that? Because, you know, it's not a bad thing that if a lot of grain production is robotics, but, you know, there's only so many dairy cow one person can look after on pasture. And so I don't know what that sweet spot is per cow, you know, how many cows per farm. But I'd rather put it into a system where we know a cow is being exposed to the land, let that system, you know, decide what's best for it. And that's kind of how I like to think, and where I want to get to is what should these systems be, and then kind of let farmers decide what's best for their production piece of land.
Are you familiar with the EU and specifically Ireland's policies on how they do government payments to farms?
Kind of. So I'm starting to look into it for maybe my next project, but I have not only a very American knowledge base. What I realized writing this book is I have a very Midwestern base of knowledge. Like, this is a whole different tangent about like California, its own ecosystem. It's just even the way land is held there, it's very different than the Midwest. So, tell me more about this Ireland EU payment system.
So, I've got a friend that has a farm in Ireland, and they do dairy and a couple other things, but he showed me his phone, the portal app that they have for these government payments, and it's honestly very, very streamlined and sleek, so it's better in that way as well. But it showed the percentage of his total income is broken down into percentage of crop payments versus percentage of practice payments. And his practice payments on bad years, for like when the milk price is down, or when the grain price is down that they sell. I think they sell some barley or wheat, I think. It can be 150% of his product payments. So stuff that he gets like as price support. So he's actually making more money. He's not getting rich by any means, but it's those down years that he counts on those payments is for the practices that he's doing. So he's essentially getting the same money each year for those practices, but some years those practices actually outweigh what he gets in crop payments. And I think to me that's where you're getting at, of like not paying people because you produced 185 bushels of corn instead of 200 per acre, not paying based on what you produce, paying based on the practices that you do. So that person might not have any, you know, conservation practices on their property that produce that 185 bushels versus 200, but they're still going to get a payment when those are public funds, so they're paid for by everybody, and you're offering no service to anybody. So if you're offering that service of like, all right, I will put in prairie strips to offer the service of mitigating erosion and keeping our waters, our streams nice and clear, those are services that benefit the greater good. So the greater good's money should be used to pay for those. And that's kind of along the same lines of how Ireland does it. And they're more looked at as like, the public is hiring you to manage our land. So here is a payment for being our land manager for the past year, essentially, is what that system looks like.
That, I would also just, it's also trusting the farmer to do it. Like, we know that you know what's best for the land. You do what you think is best. It's more communal. And I will say, just to our conversation earlier, it makes a really good tasting product. I mean, the New York Times has rated Irish butter as number one butter in the world.
And it's a direct result because they really, really, really incentivize grazing their cattle, because they see that as an ecosystem service, and they're willing to pay for it. And it's not even like, hey, produce this butter because it sells really well. They're saying, hey, do this practice, and oh, by the way, we found out that this butter is really good, and we're going to market it to the rest of the world. So now you're going to benefit on your product price is going to go up too. So like you're going to make even more money because now your product has got a lot of demand, but you're still going to get paid for your services that you're offering us. It's crazy how that happens.
No, funny. just hear me out on this little tangent. I love how you use the phrase ecological, because that's to me that's what's lost in the modern American agriculture is this. Like you talked, I mean, I realized this summer in Iowa where this whole system all people care about is how do I maximize yield on my crop this year. You're not thinking long term what's best for your piece of land for the economic health, for the system you live in minus the cancer crisis, yada yada. It really warps things. But then on the flip side, my buddies and I do a trip every year together, and we went to Louisiana a year and a half ago, and this fisherman, he does these fish trips on the weekends, and we did one with him, and I just ended up talking about like the whole fishing industry down there, and like he just had such a more ecological mindset because he had to, like he doesn't get any farm bill stuff. And like he knew the rhythm of the land. He knew when there was a storm up in the Midwest what it meant for fishing 2 days later in the bayou. He was much more in touch with the land, and he had much more pride. It made his job more fun. And like that Irish mindset, that ecologicalness is so missing from this. And it puts in people's minds this race to the bottom, destructive mindset that in the day, let's not forget, makes a bad product that then pushes people away from the product. That is like, even like going to the pork, like industrial pork is not, it doesn't taste good. Like if I fry bacon the way it used to be made and I fry industrial bacon, it's very different. And then what happens is consumers or Americans, they try this inferior product. They're like, I don't like it. I'm not going to buy it anymore. And you lose them. You lose them the fake milk, or you lose them. I mean, the other one that I always go back to is like melons. You buy any, like I buy a cantaloupe in the store and it's just no taste. I don't like it. And it wasn't until we bought a melon on the side of the road a year ago, and I realized, oh God, a melon can have a lot of flavor. Like I grew up hating cantaloupe because I just used to bad tasting cantaloupe. And so I think that's what keep in mind for farmers is even if you're doing these industrial models, is this race to the bottom eventually even undermines you doing this race, because it's just at some point there's only so many corners you can cut, then you're cutting bone.
That's a really good analogy. I want to talk a little bit more about like how we kind of talked a little bit about how the quality of life as a farmer, which generally you can extrapolate that to the rural quality of life, because a lot of people are farmers in rural areas, and just that sense of pride that you get of, you know, creating a product that you know is well taken care of and well raised, whether it be, you know, carrots or broccoli or pigs or cows or whatever it is, chickens, like that sense of pride. And I'm a farmer myself, and I produce beef and I graze cattle, and you can't get that on, like that pride is not an economy of scales sort of thing. It's actually inverse. It's like the smaller the group that you have of raising, if you have an acre garden, like you feel much more pride than if you have 200 acres of carrots that you're growing. Like it's, you get to see it hands on, and it just feels really, really good. And when you have people that are living in a community that are taking pride in their work and taking pride in the product that they have and are willing to, you know, sacrifice some of their time or money in order to produce that product, like that just inherently builds a better community. And if that, especially if that product is consumed within that community, if you can say like, all right, I sold a half of beef to my neighbor down the road, like that's a good feeling. And the person that buys it, it's a good feeling for them, because they know that although that money was maybe a little bit more or should be a little bit more than what you're going to pay at the store, that sense of like, I'm helping my neighbor feed his family by literally just feeding my family and buying the product that they raised, that he or she raised. And that builds that sense of community that frankly I don't feel much anymore in these smaller communities.
One thing I realized going back to Lena Khan is we live in this era of like life can't be dictated by Excel. I can't put into a spreadsheet how much pride you get from doing that.
You can't put a price tag on it.
You can't. And like, I mean, life is more complicated than that. I mean, even the simple thing of like, how many hogs one person should own, there's no formula in Excel for that. These are more questions we need to wrestle with as a democracy. And I think this whole era, like, you know, this cult of efficiency that's taken hold in this country has really devoided people of that. And it's lost. I mean, it's, I mean, I talk about that a little bit with my mom's bakery and my coffee chapter, where, you know, in the day, no coffee is native to Iowa. In the day, you're kind of serving the same thing. People go to a coffee shop based on the relationship they built with people. And my mom has so much pride in her business that people felt it and then they came back. Where then once you get to these big conglomerate things, you know, even where every little thing goes on the shelf, my mom was told what to do. You know, they didn't trust her as a person who worked there every day to know what's best for her community. And people feel that. And it's been lost. And like, it's getting back to that, that sense of pride. Because the pride also gives a little extra touch. You know what I mean? People want to go the extra mile. And like, also it's the local things that, you know, they're the ones that maintain nonprofits. They make those donations where, you know, underappreciated thing is like these, the second a company gets bought out and consolidated, they stop giving the local nonprofits. And
I'm really glad you're bringing up the local stuff. Because one of the questions that I've got is, and we deal with this a lot at Crawford Stewardship Project, and it seems to come up like in my daily life and just with everything, whether it's farming or solar energy or whatever it is, who gets to make those decisions? Like, should this be something that the United States government says, here's the rule, everyone follow it? Because that is equality. That is the definition of equality. Or are we a little bit more nuanced as a species, and can we say, well, there are differences within pockets of our communities, even within our state, in the same county even, there are different landscapes, different cultures, different traditions. And so is this policy landscape, is this more like we should all be playing by the exact same rule, or should we have the people that live and have to deal with the consequences, should they be the ones that are setting the rules in that area?
I mean, exactly. I mean, that is, to me, the hallmark of America is our decentralization of power, of trusting local communities to decide what's best for them. And these robber barons don't want that. They want to consolidate power. They want to remove that choice from local, because it's easier to buy out politicians in D.C. than to do it locally. And I don't know. I mean, it's also, as you were saying that, if this is such a weird little example of it, is it's like every... You go to any, like, IHOP in America, it's all the same. It's the same kind of, like, corn syrup that meh jam. But like my favorite diner in Western Iowa, Milk and Honey, Ellen, she makes her homemade jam. You know?
Shout out, she's Ellen. Like,
yeah, and here's the thing. That's not a smart economic, you know what I mean? Like, she's, no one pays for jam. She's just like, oh, I don't like the way it tastes. I'm going to make a better product for my customers. And I just noticed that when I was at a restaurant, because like my mom, you know, because she had a bakery, there's little terms in the restaurant industry called freebies. Like, you know, the condiments. Like,
yep.
And she realized, like, even though she's losing money on that, it was a sense of pride. She didn't feel that in kind of crappy tasting corn syrup jam was, you know, up to snuff for her restaurant and her clientele and, you know, her community. So she used her own money to make a better product. And it's like little, like, points of pride like that. It's a bunch of the accumulation of those little things that make a place that just improve livelihood. I mean, I can't say that enough, but when you start taking away all these little things, and here's the thing, you don't realize it overnight. It happens here and there, because like, we didn't get here overnight. It took 4 decades of this, like,
the frog in the boiling water. Is that if you throw a frog in boiling water, it'll jump out, but if you gradually warm it up, it'll never move.
But here, I mean, I also want to flip it and say, we're not going to get to the promised land overnight. It's going to take decades of work to get to that better system. And that's like something I learned from this woman named Julie Dunn. I opened my book with her. She's a retired administrative assistant in Eldora, Iowa. And she told me, like, she's doing this for her granddaughter. She hates what rural Iowa's become. And, you know, she goes through all the paperwork of every hog confinement that gets proposed, tries to, you know, stop them if she can. She loses most battles, but she keeps on fighting the good fight because she knows, you know, she doesn't want her daughter to live like this because she knows what it could be. She knows what it used to be.
What'd you say her name was? Was it Julie Dunn?
Julie Dunn.
All right. D-U-H-N. That sounds like somebody we should talk to.
Well, she's just like, I mean, she's also, I mean, what I find great and I underappreciate thing here too is nothing the people that are getting things done right now are fighting back the most are pissed off old women. That's what I realized.
That's a really good person to carry the torch, because not a lot of people are willing to really step up and say a whole lot back to pissed off old women. I know I won't.
Yeah, and like they're one. I mean, I even had this a few times in other chapters of my book. They would not want their names mentioned. I had one in particular who told me in the dairy chapter, this is just what she does. This is her extracurricular activity. She doesn't want to be, she doesn't want to know, but this is, she just is morally repulsed by what the dairy baron's doing. And, you know, she spends a few hours a week each week fighting back. And I don't know, I find that really empowering. It gives me a lot of hope.
I wanted to touch a little bit back on the idea of the homemade jam. I know it sounds weird to like extrapolate on homemade jam, but I think that is how these communities are built. You've got someone that's got a restaurant and they don't like the product that they're getting, so they make their own, and maybe they grow their business to a point where they can't make their own. So now you've got somebody down the road that is learning, that learned how to make it from you, or you show them how to make it and now they can make it. They start their own little business of doing that, and like, okay, now we've got enough that we need someone to haul our stuff, so someone else starts a business hauling the stuff. And like, that's how these communities kind of come together, is like everyone's really relying on each other. And it is a sense of pride of like the person that makes the jam is like, yeah, my jam is the jam that's down at Milk and Honey. And the person that maybe has like a refrigerated trucking service, like, I'm the one that hauls the jam that's served at Milk and Honey. Like, that's the kind of thing that it's, and even with Wisconsin and cheese curds, like that is, it's just our thing. That's something that we're proud of. That's something that came from the industry that Wisconsin is known for in the dairy world. And like, I want to have that back again in rural communities, and a lot of people do, and it's hard to see the light ahead when it seems like everything is moving in the other direction. A lot of our best and brightest, I shouldn't say that, because a lot of our best and brightest are also staying home and staying in the places where they grew up, but there is a huge outflux of people from these rural communities because they don't see that there is there's prosperity for them here anymore. The sense of pride isn't enough to keep them here to be working poor their entire life.
Well, let me just say, writing a book like this over 5 years, you realize most people are good people trying to make the world better. It's just a greed of a few people holding us back. And also, though, the people trying to fight the good fight, they are pushing a boulder uphill. And you can only do that for so long. I mean, Ella will be the first one to tell you about that, the woman who created Milk and Honey. And Julie Don will tell you that, too. But how do we level the playing field? So not only they can thrive, but then my goal is not make Ellen into a baron, but how do we copy and paste her? Like, every town should have a Milk and Honey. Because like, I mean, I even think as you're talking, I was thinking of Viroqua and Decorah to me are like examples of what the system of what rural America could be. Like, I don't want to make everyone go to Decorah. I want every small town in America to be like Decorah. Or like even going to the Irish butter example, we all shouldn't buy Kerrygold. The goal here is to make all butter like Kerrygold. And so how do we do that? I mean, we know, and that's to me is the focus on, is like, how do we level these playing fields? Because they're not playing on the same field. That's like the big thing I realized writing this book is, I mean, the system is like, you go back to slaughtering houses. It's a classic story of corporate capture. You know, the robber barons, they push a bunch of regulations to lock in their dominance. So if you're a small packer, you have all these additional regulations and, you know, red tape you have to jump through. And that just locks in the big boys' dominance. And so how do we kind of at least let them compete on a level playing field? That's all I'm asking here. I mean, that is, I don't want to be like this crazy lefty radical or whatever. It's just like, I just want people to have a chance to compete and do what, you know, trace their passions in a way that makes economical sense.
I think that's a great sentiment to kind of do a little wrap up here. I've had you for quite a while now, and we've covered quite a bit of stuff, and I really enjoyed picking your brain. And instantly when I heard you speak at the Wisconsin Farmers Union Convention, I knew I was like, I have to go and get this guy to interview him even further, because I like what he's saying, and I like the fact that you can be a little bit forward about it. Like, we're not going to dance around it and pretend like it's not happening, and that's what it seems like a lot of people do. and especially people in power, like, well, you know, you can't really talk about them because they're, you know, they're them, they're Cargill, or they're Tyson. You can't poke the bear, but eventually you kind of have to. And I enjoy that you take that stance up, Austin, and I appreciate you giving your time to come here. Again, Austin Frerich, the book Barons, it's an excellent read. And go check out, there's a whole host of books like this coming out right now. It seems to be a really hot thing of, like, people are finally wanting to take back that food system and take back the ag system. So I wish you all the best, and I hope to, well, I hope there's not a sequel to Barons. So hopefully we've got it fixed by the time you write the next one. But
I will say, Joe, first of all, thank you for having me on. And the second, the thing I didn't expect with this book is how many people come after me after talks and go, well, let me tell you about this potato baron. So I have a whole document going where I just take random notes like that. But that aside, to your listeners, I mean, I love it when people reach out to me after the book and tell me, hey, I should look here. Or, you know what I mean? That kind of, I love hearing additional, I mean, this is what I love. I mean, I love doing this stuff. I like understanding these systems. They're incredibly complex. And I mean, I really look forward to, like, trying to build a career and, like, how do we get to a better system? You know, I want to live in that. And I think we all do. And so it's easy to wallow in the darkness of this moment, but I think figuring out what you want the system to be and articulating that positive vision is what's going to inspire people to, you know, make, you know, to confront this power so we can then get to that, you know, that quote promised land.
Yeah, it's a necessary step. You got to wallow in the darkness and realize that it's a problem before you're willing to really take action. So, again, I appreciate you stopping by, and it's always a great time interviewing people, and you've been an excellent interview. So thanks, Austin. You've been listening to CSP, or Crawford Stewardship Project podcast, and you can check this out on wherever podcasts are available. There's a ton of places, so... Thanks again, Austin, and have a nice day.
Yeah, you guys too. You take care now.